Okay, folks, hi. Welcome to the review for Exam 1 for Computer Science E1. The test will be this coming Thursday in the regular lecture hall. The test will only be for an hour. We have a special surprise for the second hour. And we've split the presentation of the review material between the three TFs. Dan will be talking about hardware, I'll talk about software, and Roman will be talking about the internet.
Hi everyone, and welcome. I'll be talking to you about the first two lectures, which is, gosh, do we have any chalk? Which will be, oh, here it is. Which is about hardware, computer hardware specifically. So remember that computers compute in binary language, which is ones and zeros, of course. And so often they'll come in bits. So one bit would be a one or a zero. And then usually we refer to a byte as 8 bits. So you might have 8 ones. And so the largest number then that one byte can refer to in this case is 255. And it's important to remember how to be able to convert between binary and decimal format. And actually there's a couple of easy tricks. You can choose whichever method you want, but just real briefly I'll go over the way that I like to do it. So converting from binary to decimal in this case, remember that this is the one column, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and 128. And you can keep going. Remember, this is just doubling from the number before it. Starts at 1. You can go all the way to pretty much as high as you want. But for every number in which you have a 1, you write that number below it. Let's actually choose a different number in this case, perhaps 1011. So if we can write above it the decimal equivalents, 1, 2, 4, 8. So then every place that you have a 1, you write down the number below it. So 8, 2, 1, you just add them together, and right here, this is 11. So how can we convert then from decimal back to binary? Unfortunately, it's not quite as easy, but there's still a trick that we can do. So let's start with the number, I don't know, let's say 14. Now, in order to convert this to binary, let's divide by 2. I'm not sure if you guys have seen this trick before, but divide by 2 and take the remainder. So we divide by 2, we get 7, and no remainder. So our first number then is 0. Divide this by 2, we get 3 and 1 remainder. So you get a 1. Divide this by 2 again, you get 1 with 1 remainder. And one last time, divide by 0. Of course, is 0 and 1 remainder, 0. So 1110, that is 14 in this case. Right. Any questions about that so far? I guess, actually, I'm just going to blister through this, so we'll save the questions for a little bit later. So a computer, a calculator, all of these things process their computations in the binary language. Every time that you enter in a number through input, it's converted into binary in some form or another. So how then can computers store letters? So if you remember the ASCII code, A equals 65, and so the binary representation of 65 in a computer represents the capital letter A. And you can look up an ASCII table to see what every character means, but that's basically how that goes. Let's see. So there's also, because as you saw, we can have 8 bits to represent the number 255, we're going to get up in the number of bits very, very quickly to represent any level of data. So you can have, this is 1 byte, and then if you have 1,000 bytes, for example, that's a kilobyte. You might want to remember these the various prefixes to it, kilobyte and megabyte, etc. It goes I think. Yes, you are right. So kilobyte and megabyte. The question that was asked was the small b, doesn't that represent a bit? And I believe that is correct. The large b represents a byte in this case. So kilobytes, megabytes. Megabytes mean a million, and so on and so forth. And okay, so a computer works through the central processing unit. I call it the CPU. This is better known as the brains of the computer. And this comes in different flavors, as we know by now. Intel makes them, AMD makes them, Motorola, IBM make their different respective versions, Apple's G4, G5, and so on. And these usually are measured in hertz. And a hertz is 1/s, so it's basically the number of computations per second. But hertz is just the clock speed of the CPU, and so you'll often nowadays see them come in, not so often anymore as megahertz. More common now is gigahertz. Anything less than this, you're probably not talking about a modern computer, or anything more than this, you're not talking about a modern computer, but the supercomputer, or less than this, you might be referring to maybe even a calculator. But I think even modern calculators have megahertz processors in them now. And the CPU doesn't store any data, it only processes it. We leave that, the process, or we leave the storing up to RAM, random access memory. And RAM stores binary data inside of it, and remember that it's volatile memory, so that if you cut the power to it, it's going to forget everything that it has stored. An example of non-volatile memory would be a hard drive. Flash memory is also non-volatile memory, because that means that you can cut the power to it and it will still remember its data. So RAM often comes in sizes of high megabytes to, you know, about 512 megabytes to a couple gigabytes. I think 512 megabytes to a gigabyte is pretty accurate range for computers these days. And this is just one place that a computer will store its data. The RAM is not actually all that fast compared to the other types of memory that a computer may have. So you would have the CPU, and it has registers in it, which store very small amounts of memory, usually, what is it, like 32 bytes, I believe. And then you have, from there, you have cache. And going along the line, RAM and hard drive. So the hard drive is where you would store your permanent data. It's where you store your programs and your documents. Then when you're using those programs, they're loaded into RAM, which is volatile memory, but this is the place where your computer stores things temporarily while you're using them. And then as they're being processed, it gets sent to the cache. There's L2 cache and L1 cache. And at each successive step, the memory gets a little bit faster. So RAM is faster than hard drive, L2 is faster than RAM, L1 is faster than L2. The registers are considerably faster than any of these. And because they're faster, they're more expensive to make. So RAM may be, as I said, in the 512 megabyte range. But when you start getting down to L2, you're probably talking about 512 kilobytes to 1 megabyte. And then L1 is even smaller, usually at about 128 kilobyte. And that's because of the speed in which this cache operates. This is just for efficiency purposes. It probably is possible that they could make a computer with just RAM to see that, where the RAM is the only thing that feeds the CPU. But in that case, we're probably talking about a fairly slow computer. So that's why they have it set up in this way. And so remember that in order to boot a PC, we have the BIOS, and it stands for the Basic Input Output System. And the BIOS knows, it's software on your computer that knows how to decode ASCII code. So when you're typing stuff on your computer, it will decode the bits into, for example, from an A to 65 to the binary representation. And then this is stored in ROM on the motherboard. ROM is read-only access memory. BIOS is a software which is loaded into ROM, which is hardware on the motherboard. This also controls booting of the machine because it does the power on self-test, the post-test, and then it hands off the boot process to Windows, for example, or to the operating system. It bootstraps it. And CMOS is another type of memory on the motherboard that stores the BIOS settings. It's possible that you can go into the BIOS settings on a PC and adjust the different things that there are to adjust. The time is one example. And those settings are stored in CMOS. ROM is read-only memory, so there's no way you can change the contents of this. CMOS is a type of non-volatile memory that's based on hardware, so that the difference between, to answer your question, the difference between ROM and CMOS is that one can be written to, but the other one cannot. So you wouldn't want to store the BIOS settings in ROM because once you have them set, there's no way of changing them. Similarly, you wouldn't want to store the BIOS in CMOS, perhaps, because the BIOS is so important. You don't want it to be deleted or edited in any way. So that's why we store the BIOS in ROM and the BIOS settings in CMOS chip, because the CMOS can be edited. Does that, I hope that answers your question?
The BIOS could be stored in CMOS.
Well, a BIOS is just the program. So if a computer can read, if a computer knows where to find it, it would be able to store it anywhere. But that's perhaps a bit too confusing, because really, in modern computers, all the BIOS is stored in is ROM. And so it's just because we don't, you know, we wouldn't want someone going into the BIOS and changing it to that, to do something that wouldn't work for your machine. And so because it's such an important function, we'll leave it into ROM. And sorry? What's the difference between ROM and CMOS? Or function-wise? Function-wise, what is the difference between ROM and CMOS? So, like I said, ROM is read-only memory, and so it cannot be written to. You cannot change the contents of it. But CMOS is writable, so that if you change a setting in the BIOS, then it will change the contents of the CMOS chip to reflect the settings that you've made changes to in the BIOS. Is that a little more clear? Nope. Okay. So remember, I went over some of the basic sizes of this memory. Hard drives come in gigabytes. They have probably, modern hard drives come in 250 gigabytes, for example. Even, I think the newest ones come in 500 gigabytes. But you still see ones probably about 40 or so. Those are probably still pretty common in some of the cheaper computers. And there's also other ways that you can store data. A hard drive is just one of them. You can also do CDs and DVDs. CDs hold 650 to 700 megabytes of data, and DVDs hold about 4.7 gigabytes, the single layer, single-sided DVDs. You can have dual-layer DVDs, which hold twice that amount, but that's a different technology. And these are examples of optical storage. So that laser is actually used to read and write to CDs and DVDs. Hard drive, again, is magnetic storage. If you remember in class, in the first lecture, we broke open the floppy disks to show you the platter inside, and that's because that platter has magnetic particles on it that the computer manipulates to store to store the binary data. One pole, you know, having north up, for example, and south down is a way it might represent a one, and having south up and north down. This is just an arbitrary choice on my part. I'm not sure this is exactly how it's done, but this could represent a zero and this could represent a one. Let's see. Hard drives also have, as we saw in the floppy disks, hard drives have platters in them. So if you open up a hard disk, has a big circular thing in the middle, the head coming off of it. This is called a platter on the hard drive. It also has magnetic particles on it, and you can have multiple platters. So I think in some of the hard drives we saw, there was up to 3 platters. And the way that a hard drive works is that a file can be stored arbitrarily somewhere. So this can be our file A. And in a specific part of the hard drive, there is something called the FAT table, which stands for file allocation table. And this says that file A is stored in sector 250 or some place like that. So file A is here. But this also means that files can be broken up. So we can have another part of our file A over here, and file A even over here. We can even have part of that file perhaps on a different platter. And then the FAT table will say, okay, well, it's at 250, it's also at 500, it's also at this place over here and that place over there. And this is called fragmentation, because your file becomes fragmented on the hard drive. And so one of the ways that we defragment is that a machine will erase all the fragments and just make it one continuous fragment. This is faster than if it's fragmented, because a hard drive is able to access continuous data more quickly than searching back and forth for among the platters to find different sections of the data. And to go into more detail about CDs, they have pits and lands. You can't see them with the naked eye, but they're really, really tiny. And so you might have a pit that looks like this, and you might have a land that just looks like that, and then a pit. And then a laser reads this based on the reflection. And so I believe, I can't remember, but I think a pit will scatter the laser. And so the laser won't be returned, but a land will return the laser. And so that is how a computer will be able to tell that this is a 0 and this is a 1. And that's a 0. And these can be written on. Modern computers have CDRW drives. Some even have DVDRW drives. And they work by, instead of making pits and lands, it actually literally burns a section of the chemical so that it appears darker. So instead of spreading the light, it absorbs it, and it still reads as a 0 to computers. Yes?
So what you're talking about is CDRW, not CDR, right?
I don't know the specifics between how a CDRW and a CDR work. I believe a CDRW has chemicals in which the temperature of the laser hitting it can actually change whether it turns dark or turns light again. And I think a CDR has more basic chemicals, so that once it's burned, literally burned, you cannot restore it back to its original place, and that's why it's read-only. That's why you can write to it only once. If you're more interested in that, I ask you to look that up, because it's actually really interesting, the differences between the two. And okay, let's see. So just really quickly, remember that the CPU is the main part of the computer. The essential functions of the computer cannot be done without the cache and the CPU, for example, but we can have peripherals that are in addition to the required portions of a computer, and they give us more functionality. So actually a CD-ROM drive is an example of a peripheral, because it's not required for the computer to run. Also a printer, monitor. It's not only things that can be plugged into the outside of your computer, but inside as well. So CD-ROM drives, like I said, are built into your computer, but it's still a peripheral. And remember that all of the processing is done on the motherboard. There's a slot for a CPU, there's a couple slots for RAM, and then we also have PCI and ISA slots that allow for expansion cards to be plugged in. So you can install a network card into your PCI slot, for example, and this expands the capabilities of your computer. And there's also different ports. I'm not going to go over all of them now, but you have USB and PS2, and they have different shapes and they do different things. I encourage you to look that up and see what each one does, because it's important to know. You should be able to recognize a port just by looking at its shape and figure out whether it's USB, PS2, parallel serial, that sort of thing. And let's see. We also, briefly, monitors. have monitors is a way a computer outputs data. Remember that input is something that we input into a computer for it to process, and then the output is the processed return of it. So input, we could type something into the keyboard, and the output, it could return those characters on our screen. And some important things to remember is that there's the color depth of the monitor, and that tells us how many colors that the monitor can display, and also the resolution, sometimes 1024 by 768. And that will tell us how many pixels there are on the screen, and the width and the height. And the refresh rates and such, that's for older CRT, the TV-like displays, and that tells how many times the electron beam goes across. That's not so important, especially with the modern LCDs. The laptops have LCDs and the flat panel displays that we see. And of course, there's printers. There's different kinds of printers. There's the laser jet, which works by, again, burning a portion of the paper to form text. And then there's also inkjet, which most of us probably have at home, which has literally little tiny jets that shoot ink onto the paper. And that's the difference between the two. And I think I ran a little over time, but I think it's raised.
Any questions?
Yeah, any questions first? Yes.
What is the DMA?
DMA? From, what's
Drive
the concept?
Drive memory access.
Oh, okay. Are you referring to a specific
this
section?
There's a question in the exam, and it says, using the HDD as an extension of RAM is a feature of cache, direct memory access, virtual memory, virtual reality.
Okay, so, this is the difference between, for example, virtual memory and memory which is stored in RAM. So, you can have data and documents that are stored in RAM. The question was, what is DMA, direct memory access, and what she was referring to an example question on the exam asking about RAM and whether it was DMA or virtual memory or virtual reality, and I believe there was one other choice. But basically when data is retrieved off of the RAM, it's done by direct memory access because it's accessing the data directly from the memory. And you can actually fill up your RAM. So if you have a lot of programs open, if you have a lot of documents open, you can fill up your RAM. And then what the operating system will do is store the oldest portions of that on your hard drive temporarily. And this becomes what's called virtual memory. And this is done so that you have more space in RAM for the programs that you're using more often. And when you can switch back to these programs, and the machine will say, okay, I'll put the stuff in virtual memory back into RAM, and whatever I have in RAM, it'll put it into virtual memory, it'll actually swap. And this can sometimes be referred to as swap space, because like I said, it swaps it out of RAM and into the hard drive. Any other questions? Okay.
Sorry, it's squeaking. So just to segue from Dan's stuff into software, feel free to shout out the answer. In plain English terms, in non-technical terms, in lay terms, what's software? Feel free to yell it out. Can you say that again?
Set of instructions.
Set of instructions. How else might you describe it? It's an application, sure. How else might you describe it? Well, so
instructions to hardware to tell hardware what to do.
We've got a bunch of ideas floating. Sorry, I should cover the mic when I do that, right? I apologize to all the people at home who are getting their speakers blown out right now. So, software is a general term for the various kinds of programs used to operate computers and related devices, right? So what's the difference between software and hardware? Feel free. Right, so hardware is physical. So what does that make software?
Electronic.
Okay, yeah, so software is generally just a set of instructions in zeros and ones that the hardware executes, right? So forgive me for having my back to you. I just wanted to put up some jargon here that you probably want to be able to explain on the test. We won't be using that eraser anymore. So in general, we can think of software in two generic types, right? And I think people already alluded to them if they didn't say them outright. Applications and system software. So what's the difference between an application and a system software? Okay. Yeah, that's very good.
What the user's needs are.
Right.
Where the other one runs the machine.
Okay. So your definition is very good. Application software includes things more along the lines of web browsers, spreadsheets, word processors, video games, etc., etc., etc. System software, at least for the purposes of this class, we've only introduced the concept of operating systems. Windows, Linux, Unix, Mac OS, et cetera, et cetera. And as you guys were alluding to, system software, the functions of system software are that they communicate with and manage hardware, right? They do memory management, handle the file system, processor scheduling, they manage input-output devices, et cetera, right? Everybody okay with that so far? We really only had one lecture devoted to software, and that was a movie. And because a lot of that was highly dramatized, I just wanted to cut through some of that so that we're not confusing some of the drama for some of the actual fact. So I wrote up something. We'll probably post it later after the review session. By way of disclaimer, so I don't violate any copyrights, I borrowed this heavily from Triumph of the Nerds, which is one of the staff picks you can review for extra credit. So by way of summary, in 1975, Ed Roberts developed the MITS Altair 8800 computer. It was very difficult to use. Actually, if you remember from the movie, it was just a it didn't even have a monitor. It had a few switches and a few lights, and you had to toggle the switches back and forth in essentially what was binary along the lines of when you're actually converting binary like in problems that one. And you had to understand what the flashing lights in response meant. Not terribly user-friendly. And It was very difficult to use until Bill Gates and Paul Allen wrote a computer language for it, but even after that, it was not something grandma would use, right? It really took Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak to build the first Apple computer, which they actually created to impress their friends, not to make money, to get people to care about personal computing. And by people, I mean everybody who wasn't already interested, the non-geeks, as it were. In fact, everybody was impressed, and with a so-called killer app. Is everybody familiar with that term, killer app? That's an application that really makes a product. In the case of Apple, the first killer app was VisiCalc. It was a spreadsheeting program. It was the very first spreadsheeting program for personal computers. So do we have any accountants in here? So back in the day, and I mean back in the day, I mean if you look at a spreadsheet, if you were trying to do financial projections and each cell was predicated on, the result of each cell was predicated on the value of the previous cell, if you made a mistake here, everything in this direction was wrong. And if you had to do that by hand, ouch. So having a computer program to do that, to do some error checking, to make sure there weren't any simple math problems, I mean, that you did the addition, subtraction, multiplication correctly, it really, it was a killer app for the early Apple. By 1980, this is 80, the PC market was worth $1 billion. So that's, in today's money, I don't know what the conversion is, but that's a lot. When the personal computer was invented about 30 some odd years ago, it really wasn't about business, okay? Hobbyists built machines and they wrote software to have fun. So how did we get from there to today's world in which computers are big business? I mean, let's face it, we're all taking this class not because we're all hobbyists and we're just itching to go home and build our own computers. It's because computers are an important part of today's world, right? Well, it took a really big company that was trusted by the corporate world. Big business just wasn't interested in personal computing. At that time in corporate America, a computer still meant a mainframe, something the size of a room that cost on the order of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the idea of a $2,000 computer that sat on your desk in a molded plastic box was just not taken seriously until it had three little letters on it. And those letters were, IBM. By the late 70s, even IBM had begun to notice the explosive growth of the computer industry and companies like Apple. But up until that point, IBM's focus was still on mainframes. So in August of 1979, IBM's top management met to discuss what they termed the PC crisis. They knew that if they waited too much longer to get into the PC market, the space would be difficult to break into. So once IBM decided to enter the personal computing, top brass decided, oh, we can do this inside a year, which meant engineers didn't have time to build things from the ground up, which was until that point the IBM way. So they had to just slap things together from existing technology. But once you have a central processing unit, a monitor, and a keyboard, do you really have a PC? Well, not really. The missing ingredient was software. The operating system in particular for this first IBM, right? The operating system is like a traffic cop that tells the computer how to handle things, how the keyboard is connected to the screen, how to store files on a floppy disk. IBM needed an operating system fast, and Microsoft didn't have one. Paul Allen found one, right? You guys remember that from the flick. A guy named Tim Patterson had a very rudimentary operating system which pretty much made Microsoft's deal with IBM. Just as an aside, you won't need to know this for the test, but I had forgotten this little fact and rediscovered it preparing for this review. Tim Patterson had his product, he called it QDOS, which stood for Quick and Dirty Operating System. It was based on something developed by a guy named Gary Kildall called CPM. So in the most fundamental way, these two could have been considered equivalent products. Gary Kildall was a potential competitor for the IBM contract for the operating system for the first generation of PCs. The reason he didn't get it was because when IBM came to the headquarters of his company, which was in this big Victorian house, they refused to sign the non-disclosure agreement. So if only he had done that, that's a lot of money. So we all know that Bill Gates ended up licensing DOS to IBM, but frankly, for all its hype, the IBM PC wasn't much better than anything that had come before it. So while the IBM name generated a lot of immediate demand, I mean, IBM being the biggest, or one of the biggest, corporations to deliver technology to other businesses, it really took a killer application to sustain it. And once again, that killer application was a spreadsheet. I think those of you who have been using computers for a while would recognize the name Lotus 1-2-3. No? Yes. Going back a little bit, the Xerox Alto computer was built around 1973. Some people would argue that this was really the first personal computer, but it was actually never for sale. And the price of all the parts in aggregate was just under $10,000. So not really consumer friendly. Yeah. If you remember from the movie, the facility that Steve Jobs and his folks went to was the Palo Alto Research Center. It had all the elements of a modern computer. It had the first GUI, using a mouse to point to information on the screen. More interestingly, even back in 1973, what you saw on the screen was exactly what appeared when you sent it to your laser printer. Back in the day, that just didn't happen, okay? So they were really light years ahead of their time. When the folks at Apple saw it, and they didn't see it until 1979, they knew, okay, this was an inspiration that having a graphical user interface would help personalize and bring business computing out, make it more accessible to the user. So it's ironic because in about an hour or so of visiting Xerox Park, the folks at Apple had grasped this concept, even though for the last 6 years, the researchers at Park had been trying to convince Xerox that this was the way of the future. Just again, as an aside, Steve Jobs, and I couldn't resist sharing this quote, called them, quote unquote, copier heads. With what some folks describe as delusions of grandeur running rampant, Apple then created a Hollywood-style TV commercial symbolizing how the friendly Macintosh would free workers from the Orwellian tyranny of IBM. But despite the hype, by late 1984, the Mac sales were disastrous. In ad after ad, Apple desperately pointed out that the Mac was far easier to use than the IBM PC. Its big failing was that it cost $2,500 per unit, whereas the IBM PC was about $1,500 per unit. Businesses had a hard time justifying that extra $1,000, especially in light of the fact that at the time, Apple's product was a little bit sparse on applications. You had Mac Paint, you had Mac Write, maybe a spreadsheet program or two, but business users found that you had, again, while it might not be as pretty or as user-friendly as on the Mac, you had word processing, you had spreadsheeting, you had database and so on and so forth on the PC at nearly half the price. So sales of Mac tailed off toward the end of 1984, and that became a big problem the next year when Microsoft released Windows version 1. which wasn't particularly pretty, but with a little persistence and some constant development, the Windows graphical user interface has gotten better and better. And you know, it's the dominant desktop operating system in the world by market share today. Again, as an aside, Apple got a little bit worried every time Microsoft would release a new version of Windows and a new feature would come out that looked suspiciously like a feature on the Mac. So in 84 or 85, they sued Microsoft, and the lawsuit took 6 years, but they ultimately lost. It's hard to win a lawsuit saying that you're stealing our intellectual property when they actually borrowed it from somebody else. So for the roughly the next decade after that, really Microsoft solidified its market share. And as a segue into Roman's stuff about the internet, and as a tie-in to what Scott Bradner just told us about the internet in workshop today, I just wanted to go over just very briefly what some early internet pioneers did. Nobody ever thinks about the internet being started around the time of World War II, but a man named Vannevar Bush facilitated a relationship between the federal government, the American scientific community, and business. After the war, he helped institutionalize that relationship, and as a result, organizations like the National Science Foundation and the Advanced Research Projects Agency were started, ARPA, ARPANET, that kind of thing. So, having said all that really quickly, any questions?
Can you write that name down?
What? That won't be on the test. I mean, I'll certainly post a link or something if you're interested, but I'm fairly certain that won't be on the test. Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry, I'm confused exactly what a graphical user interface is. Is that what enables a mouse to work?
Again, apologies for the squeaky board. You remember DOS? Oh, I'm sorry. He was asking, can we sort of clarify the concept of a graphical user interface? So do you remember DOS, or have you ever used Unix or Linux? So in DOS, you might get an interface that looks like this, and you have to know and type in a bunch of esoteric commands to actually do anything with the computer. Whereas in a graphical user interface, like macOS, you have icons that you can click on. These icons are graphical in nature rather than command line. Any other questions? Issues? Comments? Yes?
I'm not sure to which part of this
relates, okay.
But what is the Huffman encoding?
Don't worry about that. We didn't cover that this year. The question was about Huffman encoding. If you're relying, I should actually make an aside about this. The past exams that are posted on the course website are just examples of the spirit of the test you'll get. Every year, the content changes slightly. We change the order in which some things are presented in order, based on whatever's current or what student interest has been or what past feedback is. So maybe we'll get to Huffman encoding in the next section of the syllabus, maybe not. Any other questions? Issues? Okay, so I think it makes sense for us to take a short break now so we can switch the tape, and then Roman will talk to us about the internet.
Let's get to the internet now. So that's the last one. Hello?
All right.
Can I ask everyone to be quiet, please? Thanks. So internet, that's the last topic. It's probably the most acronym heavy So I suggest, first of all, that everybody look at their lecture 4 and 5 jargon sheets at home, because some of the acronyms I'm going to be saying today, I might not even have time to say what they are. But let's start from the hardware side, actually, what we just found in lecture 5 of how computers can be connected. So let's say we have a couple of computers, perhaps a server, and a printer maybe. What you would find in a corporate environment today, in most networks, is a switch environment. So there's a switch sitting here, and they're connected in this fashion. This could have been different where the concept of topology comes up. Network topology is simply a way to connect networks. The two most popular ones are bus and star. Bus, if you remember, was basically one long piece of wiring cable, and then the hosts were attached on the side. So some of the drawbacks, if you remember, are first of all, congestion. If this host talks to this host at the same time, other hosts talk to each other, you know, there might be some congestion here because this piece of wire is heavily used. Another one is if something breaks here, you know, you basically lose connectivity not only between these two hosts but between a lot of hosts. And final was security, because everything gets broadcast, basically, and so this computer, when it sends message to this computer, it really says, I'm sending a message to this address, and I'm going to mention which address, but everybody can listen to it. A star topology is what we have here in a switched environment where there's a device called switch sits here. But buses, by the way, they may have sort of dumb boxes named hubs, but hubs are not much more than simple repeaters. So you can still listen to the whole network in a way. So they have the same what's called collision domain. Star topology, everyone has a different collision domain. So if this guy requests the printer, he will only get this path, and the others won't hear it, so to speak. How they find each other? They use what's called a MAC, Media Access Control Address. And the format of this is basically 12 hexadecimal numbers. Now, hexadecimal is 0 through 15, but since we don't have numbers for 10 through 15, it would be A through F. So 0 through 9 and A through F are allowed. So a typical MAC address would look something like this, for example. And this is just an example. It could be anything else. Each network card in the world has a MAC address associated with it. Each wireless network card also has a MAC address associated with it. So if your computer has a wireless card and a wired, regular wired card, you would have two MAC addresses. Another way to connect, since we touched on wireless networks, another way is to connect computers through a wireless router. The term router here is a bit misleading because it's rather a wireless switch, but they're called wireless routers. And we can have some laptops here maybe with wireless network cards that would receive traffic without actual wiring. You could also have your old desktop, perhaps, with another wireless network attached here. Some types of wireless technologies that are used our Bluetooth, which is for short-range networks like headphones. So it's not really for wiring computers, but short-range devices. What we call this is typically Wi-Fi, but Wi-Fi is a general layman term. The actual specification that describes it, the standard, is 8.2.11 followed by a letter, which is A, B, or G, but follow it just with an X. The speeds here are typically 10 megabits per second. And notice, back to Dan's distinction, the B here is small, so it's megabits per second rather than megabytes per second, but it just historically happened that network speed is measured in megabits per second or kilobits per second. To maybe 54 megabits per second. So this is for wireless, 8.2.11. There's also WiMAX, David mentioned, which is a new emerging technology for longer range wireless access as for a city. Now, how do we connect? What this is a local area network, or LAN. How do we connect it to the internet? And we'll talk about the internet next. Well, there's, other than a corporate environment at home, you would have a type of modem, which incidentally stands for modulator and demodulator, but nobody remembers that anymore. Yes, could be dial-up, which is the old type. You basically dial up as with a regular phone through a phone line. Speeds here are 28 kilobits per second. That's very slow compared to that. To 56 kilobits per second. You could also have cable and DSL, digital subscriber line. And these are typically about 1.5 megabits per second. So you can look specifics in lecture or online, but we mentioned that DSL's perhaps getting faster. And the advantage also is that you're not sharing the same media. With cable, you're sharing the same cable, so if you come home at a very popular time, chances are that connection's going to be slow. Forgot to mention what the speeds are in a typical LAN environment without actually connecting to the internet with your unshielded twisted pair cable. Well, there's 10 megabits per second again, as with wireless. And there's also 100 megabits per second is what mostly used today. Actually, there's 1,002, I think, now. Is that, yeah. Yes, that's for LAN. These are speeds for LANs. There's also optical cable that we didn't cover that is very fast, but it's mostly used in backbones these days, not in a LAN, although increasingly there. And that's a good segue to the whole internet space and backbones. So this is still a fairly small picture. We found out that we can connect through one of these devices to the outside, to the internet. But what it looks like is we have some users, say, in a neighborhood, using their DSL. To connect maybe to an ISP's router. And the ISP has a backbone. ISP is basically, it's a business, it's a company that provides access to the internet by setting up these devices and bundling up, so to speak, your connections to a backbone that goes out to perhaps another router, but we will not specify which, we will just draw it as an internet cloud. If you look at many white papers on the internet, actually, it is actually often specified as a cloud. Now, somewhere over here, let's put another router. And here, let's put a web server that is cnn.com, and it serves the web pages to you, the user. Now, what is a router? A router is basically a dedicated server, a server dedicated to transmitting messages over the internet. There are many routers here. I will denote routers in the internet cloud as dots. And the protocol that's used to transmit these messages, any sort of internet traffic, is TCP/IP. And we didn't cover in detail how it works, but packets. Packets is the general means of transmission. Any sort of information you're transmitting over the network will go in packets that have a destination address, a source address and a destination address among the information supplied in the packet. So there's the actual data. But the destination address, every server has on the internet, on the global network has an IP address, which is four numbers, typically. We write it as four numbers with dots. I'm not sure if it's the exact one, but CNN.com would have something like this. So when we specify this in our destination address for the packet in the TCP/IP, and we don't do that. An application does that. So if you're using a web browser, it does it for you. How it finds out, however, you type in CNN.com, how it finds out that CNN.com belongs to this particular one. It uses what's called a domain name system, or DNS. So presumably, it knows your DNS server. It connects to that DNS server and finds out that CNN.com is actually 64.15.16.116. And then it goes from there. It matters that the network doesn't care what kind of packet you're sending. It's always a TCP/IP packet, but the actual data, the actual application you're using in there, it doesn't differentiate between that. So it could be a web, part of a web page, part of an HTML document, part of text in an email, or it could be part of your voice conversation. Part of the data you're sending might be part of your voice if you're using an internet telephony program. One other protocol that we haven't talked about, but the concept is easy to understand, we'll cover that later in section, is Network Address Translation, or NAT. Is a protocol to allow us to translate IP addresses to MAC addresses and back and forth. So if we have an intranet, like a LAN, then we don't care. We might not even have IP addresses associated with our hosts. It's just a peer-to-peer network. We just have MAC addresses. And our LAN works just fine without IP addresses. However, if we're CNN and we have an internal network, well, one of the servers on the network happens to be a web server that has to be accessible from the outside, from the internet, then the request comes in to this server with this IP address. But we know it actually has that this server has also a MAC address. And then network address translation kicks in at the last tab to find this host on the local network. So intranet is basically anything that is a LAN, maybe, or a WAN, or wide area network. It could also be, in fact, spread over the world if you have several locations, but the important distinction is that It's something internal. It's a perhaps belonging to a company. You also have internets. This is a term rarely used with small case I, or internet works. Those are networks of networks, so to speak, networks of intranets. And that's where the term internet with capital I came from. It is the network of networks that encompasses all connected networks. The important thing that we try to stress is that it is the network, it is the infrastructure, rather than the applications that run on it. So it's not as it's used in day-to-day speak, but when we say look things up on the internet, we really mean look things up on the World Wide Web, which is just one of the things that run on the internet. World Wide Web is a collection of web pages. It uses a protocol called HTTP, or Hypertext Transfer Protocol, to transfer documents written in hypertext markup language, which we're going to be doing actually rather soon, a couple lectures down. So they're all written in this format, and that's how we see them as web pages in our web browser. Our web browser is just an application that using that can display these files properly as web pages. But there are also other protocols that run over the internet. One is FTP. That's file transfer protocol. There's SSH, which is we call it secure shell, a protocol that encrypts data end to end. Interestingly, SFTP we mentioned is simply FTP over SSH. So you encrypt your files, you establish an SSH connection, and then you encrypt your file transfer protocol messages. Finally, email uses three protocols, POP, IMAP, and SMTP. SMTP is the upstream protocol. For you to send a message to another server, you use the SMTP protocol. POP and IMAP are both download, with the distinction that when you use POP, once you access your message from the server and download it locally, it is not stored on the server anymore. You just get a copy and that's it, it's gone from the server. IMAP is more convenient in that. Yes? A question?
The last one is
SMTP. Yes, I'm sorry if it's not clear, but let's see. They're all in the jargon sheets, incidentally. A couple more we mentioned is actually IM, instant messaging, just another service that runs in the internet. And IP telephony, such as the program called Skype, that allows you to transmit voice. And these are the days they are merging anyway into products like Google Talk, which is basically instant messaging with voice capabilities. Final piece of information before we get to questions, and I will erase this. This doesn't squeak, incidentally. We found another one. Well, it's starting to, but so back to addressing on the internet, although everything will get all your names get translated to an IP address, what you type, for example, in your browser is something along these lines. I'll need a bit more space, it seems. Now, this web page doesn't exist because I'm not using my account. This is a tilde. But if I were to write a web page, I would probably start with this. So that when you visit my web page, you would type in my username and see the index.html page. Index.html gets automatically input if you don't specify anything after your last slash. Three distinct pieces of information here. Whatever goes before the colon slash slash is the protocol. And we usually omit it these days in web browsers because web browsers are only used to view HTTP traffic, as we mentioned. So it's safe to type in www.fas.harvard.edu and your web browser will supply the HTTP part. In fact, it might be even safe to type fas.harvard.edu that will supply www part these days. But that's the protocol. In fact, in Internet Explorer, if you type in FTP colon slash slash, you could actually use FTP to connect and transfer files. This is the machine you're trying to connect to, the server. This is what goes after the double slashes and before the first single slash. And everything, all the rest, is the path on the machine. So within here, we also have .edu, what's called the TLD, or top-level domain. Our harvard.edu is the domain of Harvard. fas.harvard.edu is the subdomain of the domain harvard.edu. I will actually not draw it here, but so as not to make it too clunky. But fas.harvard.edu is the subdomain, and www is actually the host. You can also send me email. No, you shouldn't send it here because I don't use this account. But each one of you has it, a similar one, and I have it too. So for email addresses, mostly same rules apply. You have the TLD here. You have domain, harvard.edu. You have subdomain, fas.harvard.edu. And finally, have the username over here. So our Rubinst is the username in this case. And last but not least, this is just some exercises we did. But if you pulled up the command utility in Windows, by going to start, run, and then typing cmd, which is basically an emulation of DOS, cmd. Some of the commands we run were ipconfig, to see what the IP configuration of our machine is. We saw MAC addresses and IP addresses. If you have two network cards, we would see two MAC addresses, for example. We would see our DNS server, for example. We used NSLOOKUP to look up the IP address manually of something like CNN.com. So NSLOOKUP CNN.com would just return the IP address of that. And we used traceroute TraceRT in Windows. On a Mac, I believe it's traceroot, right? So on a Mac, it's traceroot. You can use the Mac terminal to with largely the same commands. Is the ipconfig the same?
No, it's ifconfig.
All right. On a Mac, ipconfig is ifconfig.
You can also access the same things by going into the network utility in the utilities folder in Macintosh, and you actually that will give you a GUI-based program instead of having to do
network utilities in. Speak in the microphone.
Yeah, okay, so you can actually do the same thing on a Macintosh. The Macintosh has a terminal, and Roman is giving you some of the commands right there, but you can also open up the utilities folder in applications, and there's a utility called Network Utility, and it gives you all of these things in a nice little GUI package, and so you can actually just use that, and it's a little bit easier to use, I guess.
So that's one place where Macs are still more user-friendly because you have to be a real geek in Windows and use this black screen command prompt to use these commands. And that is about it. Any questions?
Ping.
What is?
Ping.
Ping. Oh, ping. Yeah, that's a good one. So another command we used is ping, where we try to ping is the protocol that just is a simple hello message to a server to see if it's up or down. And we mentioned that many servers these days, or routers these days, block ping requests because they may be used maliciously. We will revisit this in the security lecture. To find out whether the host is alive, you know, you can ping a whole network of hosts to see which addresses are actually alive and then target them maliciously. However, it's still a useful utility. All right, any questions?
You were going to define TCP/IP.
TCP/IP. Question is, what is TCP/IP? TCP/IP is a protocol to transmit any sort of traffic over the internet. It is a lower level protocol. And I will not, there's actually a layered structure for network traffic. But if you think of TCP/IP as the base, above are going to be all the protocols we use, like HTTP or FTP or SSH. So they all construct similarly structured packets conforming to this protocol. It's a transfer control protocol internet/internet protocol. It's a suite of two protocols. But what they basically do is break up whatever message you might have for another server. Your message may contain part of a web page or a whole web page or a file or some command. So they're very different sizes. But in any case, this message, whatever length it is, gets broken up in packets. Each of them gets a source address and a destination address and sent out on the network to the nearest router. And routers are the devices that, based on the destination IP address, they have their own algorithms of how to determine where to next send your traffic. But it is a little bit haphazard. As I drew this cloud, there are many routers, and you don't know your path. It's not determined. It's not a circuit. Every time a packet gets sent, in fact, interestingly, this packet might go this way, this packet might go that way, and still get to the same location. And then they are reassembled at the end. They might not even arrive in the same order, but then again, they get also an order number, and then they are reassembled at the end.
So by the IP, that's how it happens?
Yes, they have a packet number.
But the IP does that, correct?
IP, well, the TCP/IP protocol, the application does that, whatever it is, HTTP or FTP or SSH. So this is a lower level protocol. Yes.
Do individual computers, PC computers, have IP addresses, or only
servers, routers. The question is whether individual PC computers, or Macintosh, if they have IP addresses along with routers and servers. Incidentally, yes, all routers also have necessarily an IP address. Some of them do. The answer is some of them do and some of them don't, depending whether they want to be part of the internet, the larger network. In anything that's linked to the internet, probably yes. Sometimes they're not static, what are called static IP addresses. And in that case, probably chances at Harvard this is used is DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, where you as a host request an IP address, and then your nearest router allocates you, or your switch allocates you an IP address. But definitely, if you are connected to if you are connected to the internet, if you're not just connecting two computers, then if you run something like ipconfig on your machine, you will see your IP address. Yes.
In your internet diagram, where does the port fit
in? The question is, in the internet diagram, where does the port fit in? It's an excellent question. In fact, it doesn't really fit in the internet diagram. Internet is the TCP/IP realm. But once your packet over here gets from one machine to another machine, the last piece of information it needs to get to the right place, since they're all TCP/IP packets, is what application it's going to use, HTTP, FTP, SSH, because remember, it's all zeros and ones, and you don't know whether it's part of your voice conversation or part of a web page or an email page. And that's where the port number comes in. Each one of these applications has a different port number. Default port number for HTTP is 80. FTP is at 21.
Yes.
And SSH, I believe, is 22. So that's where it comes in. Yes?
Are there standard suffixes on the path? And I don't know if in use paths, are they being phased out?
Question is, are there standard suffixes and standard way to write paths? No, paths, in fact, you can write in any way you want. One interesting thing, actually, a distinction is any part of the domain name can be capitalized without spoiling the picture. It doesn't matter. They're case insensitive. However, here, the path names matter. So if you type rrubinst with a capital T, if that user, that's a different user and probably wouldn't be found. But there are no standards, and each server decides how to do it. There is a de facto standard to use index.html. If you go to just www.fas.harvard.edu and /index.html, that will pull the first web page. Usually you use links after that anyway, so nobody cares about what path. Something like cnn.com doesn't make you type in different /weather. You know, if you type cnn.com/weather, it will bring up the weather page. However, you just go usually these days to cnn.com and click the weather link. Also, there are some components, there are some dynamic scripting languages that we haven't covered used on web pages that make your paths. If you look at your most addresses these days, they're not as clean cut and nice as these guys. So there's usually no way to remember. So no, there is no standard, really. Questions? Any more questions? No questions. So I'm going to pass over to Ray now, and we're going to call the general exam logistics.
So first of all, thanks everybody for weathering this, especially those of you who've been here since section this morning. I know that's a very, very long time, and I also promised you guys that the next time I do Saturday section, I'll bring coffee. Um, do keep in mind that at course's start, David offered a slide of a hack from MIT where somebody had hooked up a fire hydrant to the water fountain. And just to reiterate, that's what this course is. It's a broad survey course. We cover a lot of topics, not in any terrible depth, but it's a lot to swallow at once. Don't try to swallow it all, and you'll probably likely be a little bit happier. If you think about the material on this course on a continuum with this side being difficult and this side being easy, you probably, in terms of just test preparation hints, you probably don't want to deal with the extremely difficult stuff and the extremely easy stuff. But the stuff in the middle is probably going to be the most productive for you to study, okay? If you find this hardware stuff really, really difficult, that's okay. Set it aside, and if you get to it, great. And if you don't, that's fine. Those of you who took a look at the exam samples from last year probably noticed that in the body of the exam itself, we give you a lot of hints. For example, question one from last year was the internet and the World Wide Web, and this was a multiple choice question. The internet and the World Wide Web are A, not the same thing, B, not the same thing, C, not the same thing, and D, not the same thing. So it's really not going to be a scary experience, I promise. Okay? So having said that, any last minute general questions about anything we've covered in the course so far? Okay, great. We will see you all next Thursday. Have a good weekend, what's left of it. And don't hesitate to email us with any questions.